Hello and welcome to The Dirt, NFCA podcast presented by Netting Professionals. We are thrilled to bring you weekly podcasts covering a wide variety of topics from industry leaders. You can listen to all our past episodes through Apple iTunes or anywhere you listen to podcasts. We are glad you are joining us today. Enjoy the show.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Dirt NFCA podcast presented by Netting Professionals. It's hard to believe it, but 5 years ago, we did a podcast on batting order. And recently, a few coaches have reached out and talked about, hey, what's changed? Is there anything going on with this? There's coaches that are listening to this podcast every year, believe it or not, Coach Michael, and they love it. And we wanted to revisit it. So a big welcome to Matt Michael from Arkansas, who's going to help walk us through using statistics and understanding metrics in order to set your batting order, your lineup. So thank you, Coach, for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And people probably don't know this, actually the third time we're doing this, because the first time it didn't record. So that's how
that's how early
you were in the podcast days. It was still technical.
I forgot about that.
Yeah. I don't know why I just called myself out. We'll forget, not do that anymore. But let's think about the batting order from a numerical perspective in terms of plate appearances. Are there things when you look at the number of plate appearances a hitter has throughout the year that immediately make you think of places they should or shouldn't be in the batting order?
Yeah, I think the big thing to realize first and foremost is that you're gonna be giving your players at the top of the batting order up several more plate appearances per year than you are the players at the bottom. So with each decreasing lineup spot, they're going to be getting, at our level, the college level where you're playing 50 plus games, they're going to be getting 6 to 7 more plate appearances, sometimes 8, depending upon the lineup spot, per year more. So the one hole will get about 6 or 7 more than the two hole, and then likewise down to the end. So you're looking at the difference between the one hole and the nine hole. It's probably the difference of 60 plate appearances. So really what it comes down to is being able to put players that are going to get your most amount of plate appearances in the lineup that are going to be the most productive hitters you've got. So those are really the things that you got to be able to use in the end. And then from there, there's certainly things about those lineup spots that are kind of conducive to how often do they hit with runners on base? How often do they hit with runners in scoring position? But really in the end, more so than anything, you kind of have to start that decision with, who do you want to have your most at bats? How often are you wanting certain players to be up in certain situations? So really that's kind of the starting spot. I mean, I think that if you can kind of use that as a rough 50 game number, and that doesn't necessarily deviate by team by team. I mean, what it comes down to is at the end of a game, somebody's going to have your last at bat. You know, it might be your 3-hole this game and your 4-hole didn't get it. 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8, and 9 did not get a hit as often as 1, 2, and 3. So every game that you end, you're going to have somebody get your last at bat, and all of the hitters in the lineup behind it will get one less. And then that starts to stack up over the course of time. So it doesn't matter if you're the best offense in the country or you're somewhere in the middle or towards the bottom, you're going to be giving, it's kind of a universal fact and theme of the game. So it doesn't really matter if you're a college team, you're a high school team, you're a club team, you're a professional team. It doesn't really matter on that front. It's just kind of one of those situations where you got to know who you're giving the most at bats to. So I think that's the first decision as far as how you're making your lineup.
And that's huge, because if you think about your best hitter, and if you had traditionally put them in the 3 or 4 spot, you're talking potentially a 10 game differential almost. Yeah. And the number of plate appearances that they may see. And we've seen that a little bit through the years where you used to take that best hitter and immediately they were in the 3 or 4 spot. And then you see some people making moves of, if they're going to walk them, I'm going to put them in the leadoff spot and doing some of those things. So the number one trait you want in your leadoff hitter, or the parts of the package that your leadoff hitter needs to have, no longer just your fastest kid, right? What are the things that your leadoff hitter should be able to do extremely well?
I think fast is important. I just don't think it's the number one trait that you would make that decision off of. I think that if you can have somebody that's fast there, in addition to being able to be kind of your best on base person, you really want your best on base person that doesn't have power. Now, sometimes your best on base person is going to be your best power person. I would probably not suggest putting your best on base if they have a ton of power in that spot. And the reason for that is they literally hit with runners on base probably about 12% less than the next closest person. So only 38% of the time do they hit with runners on base compared to the nine hole who hits that in that spot just over 50% of the time. And then additionally, they hit with runners in scoring position less than 25% of the time. And then the nine hole actually hits in that spot a little bit over 30%. So it's really a spot that is going to, first of all, get your most amount of plate appearances. So you're not wanting to make outs in that spot by any means, because they're going to get the most on your team in the course of the season. It's certainly good to have power or speed in that spot. It's not really important to have power. I don't know that we've really traditionally kind of as a sport put power in that spot, but it is something that you really want to make your first decision off of on base percentage. Is this somebody that's going to be able to keep you from making outs in that spot and be able to kind of generate some flow in your offense out of the start? And really in the end, it just, like I said, it comes down to they're getting six more at the college level over the course of 50 plus games. They're getting six more plate appearances in a season than your two hole. They're getting 14 more on average than your three hole. And they're getting about 50, mid 50s to 60 at bats more than the nine hole. So those are kind of all the decisions that would go into that spot. Like I said, I think that speed is a good thing, but it's not a necessity there. But you want somebody that can get on base in that spot.
And, you know, we were talking a little bit off air about that number two hole hitter. And, you know, it used to be the grave mistake is the mismanagement of the two spot, right? And so that's something that maybe we have seen teams adjust a little bit with on who they put in the two hole. I have my on base kid and I'm ready. I know who that's going to be in the number one spot. What am I looking for in the number two spot?
Yeah, I think that was kind of the biggest mistake that was kind of made, I would say, prior to, you know, I think even in the last couple of years is where it's really been utilized very well across the board at many levels as I've seen it. But yeah, it was kind of really thought as a traditional bat handler. Like you said, the one hole gets on. We maybe had that person bunt them up. Somebody that could handle the bat, didn't strike out much, was able to move the one hole to set up the three and the four hole. And really, you know, if you could get that out of the two hole while you were getting some production and on base, then that's one thing. But to stick somebody that maybe should be down in your lineup in that spot, that was something that could really end up costing you runs because of the volume of plate appearances they're getting compared to that eight or nine or even seven spot. I mean, you're talking 40 plus just between the two and the seven spot. You're talking on average 42 plate appearances. So when you multiply the difference in the runs that are generated by having certain on-base percentages, certain OPSs, OPS being the addition of on-base percentage and slugging percentage, which is a really important metric as far as being able to predict run scoring. So if you can have somebody in that spot, I think really quite honestly, from a national level, you're seeing, to me, a lot more and more of the best and maybe even second best hitters in a lineup sitting in that spot. And really, you know, if you look at just the gap between two and four, as far as the amount of plate appearances they're going to get in a season over the course of 50 plus games, you're looking at the difference of 13 plate appearances between the two and four hole alone. So really kind of what it comes down to is that two hole starts to hit with runners on base above 50% of the time, which is where the rest of the lineup spots sit. Not quite as much as the four hole. The four hole is kind of king, and we'll talk about that later as far as runners in scoring position and runners on base, but it's certainly at a high enough rate that they'll be able to drive in runs. But it's kind of managing that space of having kind of a perfect mix of setting them up to have runners on base and drive in runs, and then also giving them extra plate appearances. So, you know, at the end of the season, I think that that what you're seeing is you're starting to see some of the best hitters in the game being in that spot. I mean, Patty Gasso puts Jocelyn Allo in the two hole. And in moments when she hasn't been in the two hole a couple of times last year, you're talking about Tiara Jennings. You mean, so you're talking about first team All-Americans. You're talking about maybe the best hitter in the game currently in Allo, and maybe in a couple of years, we're talking about Jennings being the best player in the game. So, and you're seeing that across the board. Last year at Arkansas, we had 25 home runs in our two hole out of Braxton Burnside, first team All-American. I know that we're not the only two teams out there, just kind of the examples that come off the top of my head. But, you know, I mean, the difference between putting a player like that and putting maybe your traditional eight hole hitter in that spot in the lineup, you're talking about over the course of a season. I mean, that could be, I don't have that number in front of me, Joanna, but I mean, that number, I believe, was in the range of 30 runs.
As far as, yeah, I have as a note here from you. The, yeah, from the last time we talked about, you know, the double digit number of runs a year that can translate to versus that traditional 7-8-9 hitter. You know, you put them in, they're gonna bunt, you're gonna hit behind a runner, you're gonna, you know, do something a little more station to station. And yeah, that's 20 plus runs a year. And,
yeah.
And that's a huge, huge difference when you're thinking about ultimately, you know, scoring runs to win.
A message from our official sponsor, Netting Professionals, improving programs one facility at a time. Netting Professionals specializes in the design, fabrication, and installation of custom netting for backstops, batting cages, dugouts, BP screens, and ball carts. They also design and install digital graphic wall padding, windscreen, dugout benches, and more. Contact them today at 844-620-2707 or visit nettingpros.com. Follow at Netting Pros on social media for their latest projects. Now, back to the podcast.
How about the next one, Matt? You think about the three hitter. You know, I remember always thinking decades ago that you're just, your best hitter went there. Just the best hitter you have went in the three spot. What are we seeing out of that lineup spot, and what traits does the hitter need to have because of the characteristics that spot provides?
Yeah, I think the three hole is still a vastly important spot in the lineup. I mean, you're still kind of tackling that. They're going to get extra plate appearances. They're going to get more than the four, more than the five and the six and so on, fourth down the lineup. Like you said, they were traditionally kind of like your best hitter. I mean, you set it up to really get them people on base, for them to be able to have them drive in runners. And it could still be a little bit of that, but metrically throughout the course of time, four has really kind of become that spot. Four hits with runners on base about 3% of the time more, and also with runners in scoring position about 3% of the time. So, I mean, it's not a vast difference. You know, if you're still somebody that's putting your best hitter in the three hole, that's not a huge blunder on your end. That's not costing you a ton of runs. It's just kind of informationally, the four actually tends to hit in that spot a lot more often. Over the course of a career, a few times more over the course of a season. You're talking about they're going to hit with runner in the typical 56 game season. You're going to have three more plate appearances with runners on base, and you're going to have almost four more plate appearances than the three hole with runners in scoring position. So it's a move certainly you could make at times. I know that it's somewhat of this. I mean, throughout the course of all of this conversation, you know, these are moves to make. I certainly think if you're somebody that maybe would feel like that you need to put just a bat handler in the two hole, I think that's the one space that maybe would stick out to you, maybe an adjustment you could make. But for the most part, there still is like lineup spot comfortability. You mean, you're still dealing with, as much as we talk about the numbers and the metrics of this, and we know at the end of the day, we're still dealing with human beings with emotions and trying to coach players in that. And they all have their preconceived notions about where they should be and what the spots should be. So I think through time at Arkansas, we've had those conversations about, you know, look, this is why you're here and this is why we're putting you here as compared to being in this spot, because this is what you're going to get out of it. You're going to get a couple extra times with runners on base this season. You're going to get a few extra times with runners in scoring position. So three is still a good spot. Don't get me wrong. I mean, you're still in those front three. It's still somebody, you know, one of the things I think that sometimes the metrics don't catch is it's still somebody that the defense is guaranteed to have to pitch to in the first inning. So, you know, that spot is still there. I just think you have to be aware now, and the metrics really haven't changed from 5 years ago, that the four hole is going to hit a little bit more often with runners on base and a little bit more often with runners in scoring position. So that could be maybe if you wanted to gravitate towards making a metric move, it might be putting your best hitter in the four hole.
And so, Matt, when you think about the kids that you've coached in the past and they just have the clutch gene, there's just something about them that they perform better with runners in scoring position, or, you know, they seem comfortable in those scenarios. How do you go through that in your mind of, you know, that gut feeling or the sense of what you said before, there's still people and you have their comfortability piece and just their ability to perform in those situations, even if they're, you know, statistics show that person A is more power, person B is higher on base. It just feels like, you know, this other individual does better in those situations.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's one of the things that, as a coach, you know, speaking on this topic, having people ask me to speak on it, speaking at the convention a few years back, doing this podcast now a couple of times on it, and people kind of seeking out there my advice at times, it's, I will say this across the board is for the most part, generally coaches do a really good job of building a lineup. The difference between optimal, like the perfectly optimal lineup and the suboptimal lineup is several runs over the course of a game, but suboptimal lineups are so vastly different from what a coach would typically put together that you're really not going to go to that. So I'm really kind of making that point is like, there are certain things within the framework of your team that the numbers aren't going to necessarily see. There's going to be those players that you feel like have that little bit of that clutch gene. Like you said, there's going to be those players that have always hit in this spot in the lineup. And for some reason they, in their mind, they need to hit in that spot in the lineup. And it might be one spot from where you want them to be. You mean it might be, you want them to be in the four and they want to be in the three because they think the three is this, that, and this. You mean, and it's in the end, would metrically it be better for them to be in the four? Yeah, probably. But is it that big a deal to make a change and make them hit in a position where maybe they don't perform their best? I don't know that it's worth that. So I think there's just so many things that as coaches we go through and we tackle every year, and we know that that are part of it that really are going to be part of that decision. So it's talking about the metrics for sure, but you know, there's not a vast difference in the quality of the lineup other than if you're making that massive mistake in the two hole. I think throughout the course of time, that's been the one spot that's hemorrhaged it. But you know, quite honestly, there's lots of tools out there now since the analytic end has really exploded as far as there's smart people that are able to really do and put together the math on it and the algorithms and be able to work with the data and scrape the data and grab the data on a national level that can provide these services. Those are the things that, you know, kind of a lot of the college programs are starting to kind of take advantage of.
And not being seen as an endorsement in any way, shape, or format, but for someone who's listening that has no idea that exists, what are some of the resources and places they can go to try to find that information?
I'll tell you what, it's not an endorsement. There's some great companies out there. There's some great companies that you'd run across at the NFCA convention. One in particular is Sequencer is a company. And like I said, it's not an endorsement of them. There are also, there's free tools out there for people that, you know, don't necessarily have the funds or the ability to be able to pay for a service like Sequencer that would help you optimize your lineup and help you with decisions, in-game decisions that they do. But there are, I mean, just a simple Google search about lineup spot optimization tools. You mean, there's a few things out there that when you use the statistics of your players, put them in and kind of check as far as what would be some optimal lineups that you could build. You know, those are things that we've used in the past. We currently do use Sequencer. And so I'm going to be honest with you. I mean, the lineups that pop up that are optimal, I mean, we're going to maybe use one of the 15 options that are popped out, because there's so many different permutations and combinations that we made out of the course of 9 spots in the lineup, much less the 18 or 20 players that you might put in. So the amount of that they pop out at you are kind of endless. So it's certainly on our end, it's kind of balancing that. Okay, do we have anybody in our lineup that really is married to or has to be stuck in a spot? Or can we go with this? You mean, and it's kind of managing the numbers with managing the human.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, that kind of leads us to the middle of the lineup in the number 5 spot. You know, are there things that person tends to see more than some others, or where do we start thinking about the lineup as we kind of crest the hill and we're at the midway?
I think that when you're looking at these spots, kind of dissecting, we dissected 1, 2, we dissected 3 and 4 kind of together a little bit. One of the things, and kind of summarizing that 3-4 dissection, I think 4 is kind of the new 3, in the sense that realistically they probably, if you can afford to put your best hitter in that spot because of the amount of times they're going to come up. 3 kind of was a little bit like the old 4, where it's a little bit more of the big power spot. I think you're going to be helped a little bit more by power in that spot by the amount of times that they get on base, or by the amount of times that they have players hitting or on base in front of them, excuse me, and in with runners in scoring position. So 3 kind of becomes the old 4. I think 5 is a little bit of a sneaky spot in the sense that you really can provide yourself some value in that spot. If you've got somebody that hits like a high on base percentage, high average person that doesn't necessarily have a lot of power, that you aren't going to stick in either your 2 or your 4 hole. So, you know, we happen to have somebody in our lineup that's kind of really a perfect fit for that 5 hole hitter this year. Somebody that's not traditionally hit for, I mean, our program is done pretty well in the home run category here lately. And our lineup is pretty blessed in that nature this year. So I'm gathering we're going to generate some home runs, but we've got somebody that really is a career 330 level hitter that in the past is almost hit 400 a couple of different seasons, but not somebody that's going to go for more than likely maybe go for 8 or more in our lineup, where we're going to have probably 4 or 5 people go for double digits. And so it's somebody that really can provide you a lot of run production in that spot. If you've got somebody that's really a singles, doubles, triples, and kind of a walks person, somebody that avoids outs a little bit more than maybe that slugger you would maybe stick in your 3 hole, depending upon the makeup of your lineup. So that's kind of the middle 3 spots in there, you know, the 4 hole being the old 3 hole, the 3 hole kind of being the old 4 hole. And then the 5 really, you know, at that spot, if you don't have people that kind of fit into it, really, quite honestly, if you don't have people that fit into all of these little niches, I mean, you could be pretty darn close to building an optimal lineup by just hitting your players from 1 to 9 in greatest to least on base percentage. I mean, really, when you kind of slice and dice it, you wouldn't be that far off of the optimal spot. You'd generate a ton of runs because in the end of the day, you're just dealing with 21 outs. Once you run out of your 21 outs, you know, your time, unless you go into extra innings, is up. So if you can give the players that avoid making outs the most amount of plate appearances, you're going to end up generating runs. And I think it's one of those situations where sometimes, you know, we get really sucked into the whole power piece, but really what it comes down to is really avoiding outs as much as you can. I think there's no question that last year's Oklahoma lineup was amazing. I mean, they were the most amazing offensive metric lineup that we've seen in our game ever, as far as run generation and all of that. And certainly they led the country in all of the major statistics, but you know, they could have probably hit another or 20 less home runs and still been up there in run scoring just because of the rate at which they didn't make outs.
And so when you think about that, Matt, from a standpoint of, okay, I've got three hitters or I've got four hitters that I feel are, you know, very good. And then I'm stuck, whether it's, you know, you've got injuries or it's just a down year, whatever it might be. How do you optimize, you know, those three or four hitters if you really are going to rely on them to, you know, provide your run support throughout the year?
Yeah, I would first and foremost, like, I think the hardest thing to decide is, okay, we've got, and I've been there before. I think we've all been there before in the cycling of what's going on. Do I put them together or do I break them up? You mean? I think that's the biggest decision and the hardest decision you're making. In the end, putting them together is always going to be able to optimize your ability to be able to score runs, given the framework of what you've got at the moment. And then at that point, certainly it can be feel at times like a little bit of a black hole of outs when your outs are strung together. Certainly not that you're not trying to, but at that point, you're really just trying to, with the other five, emphasize any way that you can to get on base. I think your decisions are going to be different down there, and they tend to be different across the board as far as, you know, how much are you going to be sack bunting to try to just maximize any sort of movement out of that. But I think first and foremost, if you've only got three, I would stick them in the one, two, and four spot, maybe three spot. I shouldn't say maybe with that kind of emphasis, because I don't think sticking them one, two, three is going to cost you a ton more than sticking them one, two, and four. One, two, and four would just kind of be a little bit more optimal. But it just depends on how far a drop off between the third best hitter and the fourth best hitter. You mean, if you have a vast drop off, I probably would stick him one, two, and three, line him up in that space right there. If you've got four, I would stick him one, two, three, and four and go from there. Score runs when you have, and it puts a bit of pressure on them. But I think that you're going to find that they're going to feel pressure in any spots in the lineup that they're in. If you really only have four of them, if you break them up a little bit, maybe stick him one, two, four, and I don't know, six or seven on that front. I don't know that you'd do that, but they're still going to feel that pressure if they're your four best hitters. So bunching them together doesn't make them feel any more or any less than they're feeling. They're still going to, they still kind of know that they have that feeling. I can tell you right now, I mean, we all know as coaches, they have that feeling of that they're having to kind of do most of the work. So I would just encourage you to keep them really tight together, if not consecutive together, maybe broken up by one spot in that three hole.
Sure. And how about the kid that gets pitched around all the time? Is there somewhere that you should put them knowing their walk number is going to be high because of, you know, how good they are? You think about the, you know, Veronica Nelson from way back, or, you know, just the kids that aren't going to see as many good pitches to hit.
Yeah, I think that's a huge part of the lineup generation that has to be considered, as well as all of the metrics that I'm kind of sharing with you or that come across the board. It just becomes anybody that you've got in that is going to be either is going to be a high walk person just because of the discipline that they've got, or because of the pressure that they apply. Those tend to be the two reasons that people walk. Throughout the course of time, I used to think it was more of an eyepiece, but now it's certainly tends to, just metrically kind of looking at it, tends to be more of a pressure piece. The more pressure through high batting average, through high slugging percentage, through doubles and home runs, the more that you apply there, the more that you tend to see the walk rate increase. But really, in the end, if you've got somebody that's in that space that you know that's going to be that person, you need to be able to both protect them from a traditional protecting standpoint, but also just a metric standpoint. I think that as more and more people are looking to metrics to make informed decisions, there are certainly metrics that need to be met that to kind of give you an opportunity to intentionally walk someone. So I would say if you've got somebody that you feel like is your most productive hitter and has that number, you certainly need to be protecting them with somebody that is got some on-base percentage, some slugging percentage behind them that can give them a little bit of protection. Now, you might run out of it. You might only have three hitters that really meet any of those criteria, and you need two of them out in front of that, the big player. And you're probably, I would say this, kind of using an example, if you've got three hitters, and one of the challenges of going 1, 2, and 4 sometimes is that, okay, then do in that space, I'm going to have to put my fourth best player in the 5 hole. So do you want to put your fourth best player in the 5 hole, or do you feel like you need to put him in the 3 hole? And so if you feel like, okay, I don't want to put him down in the 5 hole, I've only got three, I've got a fourth that's is clearly probably my fourth best player, but just not as good as the other three as far as on-base percentage, slugging percentage, those type of things, then that probably would be conducive. Okay, I'm going to put my best hitter in the 3 hole. I'm going to put my fourth best hitter in the 4 hole. So I get some protection. So I get a little bit of productivity behind them as far as the run production goes when that 3 hole gets on, gets pitched around. And really what it comes down to is the better the hitter is behind that hitter that they're thinking about walking, whether they have the metrics or not, it's still going to play into the decision of, okay, I can walk this person or I can't walk this person. So that's certainly part of the decisions on a game by game basis. As far, in addition to the metrics, we are a program that has the metrics as far as knowing exactly what we're going to have in a threshold in each spot to be able to walk somebody. And so we're using that same thing to make our lineup. I mean, making sure that we're not giving other teams opportunities to be able to pitch around certain people. Or if they do, if they choose to make that decision metrically, we're going to hopefully be able to make them pay for that at a higher rate.
For sure. You know, and what if you're a team, Matt, that loves the short game? You're going to have 3 or 4 triple threat or slappers in your lineup. You're going to steal bases regularly. Are any of these, metric analysis points, are any of them different if you know you're going to be a slapper heavy?
I don't know that it matters if you're slapper heavy or power heavy. The concepts are still the concepts in the sense that you have to ask yourself, am I slapper heavy and are my slappers really, really, I shouldn't say really, really good. I don't have to emphasize that much. Are they really good? You mean, do I have a slapper that is a triple threat slapper that can, it's a really high base percentage person. Obviously they've got speed that's in their game, and they might even have the ability to have a small amount of power. I mean, in the end, you could afford to go 1 and 2. I mean, going 1 and 2 is not a mistake with slappers. I think if you've got 3 slappers and 2 of them are great, and 1 of them's serviceable, you probably might go 9, 1, and 2 with them, with the least of the 3 being in the 9 hole, probably the best of the 3 being in the 2 hole. And then maybe the second best in the 1 hole. It all just comes down to kind of your personnel and who they are. I think that if you've got 3 slappers in your lineup and 2 of them are just happen to be better than other options, but they're not really the best options on your team, I would still probably line them up together, 8, 9, and 1 spot. Maybe break them up in there. I mean, there's nothing to say that they've got to be 3 consecutive. I mean, you could break them up and go 7, 9, and 1 in there. But it really comes down to what's the quality of your slappers. I mean, if you've got really good slappers, you shouldn't shy away from putting them at the top, like in that traditional 1-2 spot that our sport has used a lot out of our slappers. If you've got really high end on base percentage slappers and you've got one that can maybe do just a little bit more than that, 2 would be a good spot for them. But like I said, sometimes our lineups are lean enough that the slapper is just maybe the better option than somebody that's not a slapper. Or maybe you have 2 slappers. And in that case, I would put them towards the bottom of the lineup. You know what I mean? In the 8-9 spots, the 7-9 spots in there, depending upon your personnel set and and what you're going to do with him.
And for those bottom of the lineup spots, you know, Matt, I think the only thing we've talked about so far this time in those is the decreasing on base percentage, maybe as a guide. Are there any other things you would suggest that coaches look at when they're balancing out or rounding out the bottom of their order?
I think for the most part, I mean, there's not a lot of real nuances in there. I mean, there's some here and there. But really at the end of the day, I think the first on the checklist in looking at that is literally just kind of a decreasing order of on-base percentage or decreasing order of OPS or decreasing order of, skilled hitter, however you want to term it. If you're not looking at the numbers, you still have a pretty good idea of like who your seventh best hitter is, who your eighth best hitter is, and who your ninth best hitter is. And you know, there's some times where I think you're going to see in lineups where maybe your worst hitter is in your eight hole, dependent upon the structure of what you've got going on. Maybe you've got a slapper you want to put in the nine hole that maybe is truly like your sixth or seventh best hitter. They just don't necessarily fit in those spots up there. You want to maybe you're feeling like you're not that worried about the difference in the amount of plate appearances they get between the seven and the nine spot. You might put them in the nine spot. And then you put your worst hitter in the eight hole. Really, in the end, it becomes, at the end of the day, certainly your three worst hitters or your three hitters that are going to generate the least amount of OPS, on-base percentage, slugging percentage, those things should sit in those bottom three spots. And then from there, there's a few different nuances over the course of time as far as maybe foot speed, you know, out in front of certain spots. I mean, there's all kinds of things that the metrics aren't going to necessarily catch that I think are fine decisions. You just want to be, I think probably the gravest thing continuing to kind of circle back to it would be sticking somebody that maybe is your sixth or seventh best hitter, maybe even eighth best hitter, but is a good bunter in that two hole. I think that's something we've done in our sport a little too often historically. So as long as you're not making that decision, I think you're fine as far as setting those bottom three spots.
And Matt, you mentioned OPS, on base, slugging in different aspects. Are there other statistics that really correlate the amount of runs a team can score? You know, is it extra base hits? You know, is it, what is it that you know, can really identify, okay, this is how I'm going to score my runs?
Yeah. I mean, I think there's every statistic out there is going to correlate at some level. You know, some statistics correlate it at an extremely high level. Some correlate at a mediocre level, some's correlated at a really low level. So, but everything's going to correlate in one way or another. It just becomes trying to be able to understand which ones correlate the most so that we can put our focus on that. I will tell you that traditionally, you know, one of the things that our eyes been drawn to throughout the course of baseball and softball through time is batting average. And batting average is not, and it kind of was king. I think that the metric movement isn't saying that batting average is bad by any means. Batting average has a really high correlation. It's probably in the top six as far as any metrics across the board, advanced or not advanced, as far as how much it correlates. It's just not king. OPS is, there's even more advanced than that, but as far as the easy ones to calculate quickly, OPS is kind of the king piece in there as far as that goes. And then on-base percentage would be next, and then on slugging percentage, and then batting average. But they're all three of those are going to correlate at an even higher rate than the rate at which you double or the rate at which you hit home runs or extra base hits per plate appearance, those things. They're all out there. But I would just look at for those that maybe don't dive and look at it every day, because you have to have a contextual framework in your head of what is good in each of those statistics. You mean, it's one thing to look at OPS, but it's another thing to know, is 650 good or is 950 good? Is seven? And of course, when you're comparing two next to each other, you know that 650 is better than 643, but like what do they compare to over the course of the time? And I think that we've looked at enough batting averages. We have that context. We know that on-base percentage is going to have to be a bit higher than that, you know, 7,500, 120 points higher than that, slugging percentage as well. So to, you know, long story short, I would keep you with still some of those ones that you've looked at all of your life. I would just kind of chase you towards OPS as something you're making decisions. I would look at on-base percentage before I looked at batting average, but batting average is still a huge correlator of runs at the team level and at the individual level.
How about for the people that love to steal bases? Is there a number that they should be looking at of, you know, hey, if you're not stealing at a certain clip, then it's really not helping you?
Yeah, I think that it doesn't really matter the level you're at. 75% is kind of that golden number. If you're not stealing that at that clip, you're not helping yourself. Certainly, I think the goal should be to try to be able to maximize volume, which I think is always a goal in stolen bases, with stolen base percentage. You know, so it's one of those things where sometimes I think we get lost in the volume alone. And, you know, we maybe at a team level, we're celebrating stealing 100, 150, 200 bases, but, you know, we're stealing them at a 74% clip. And that's not necessarily even as valuable as a team that maybe steals 60 bases at an 84% clip. So what it becomes is trying to be able to pick and choose those opportunities where, whether it be the opposing catcher, whether it be your personnel set, whether it be the coverage system, all of those things, but just picking and choosing right opportunities to be able to get those percentages up. I think there's lots of teams out there that do it really well. There's no question about that. There's plenty of teams out there that steal on the top side of 80%, which is certainly better than 75. And there's some that steal on the top side of 85 and approaching 90% at a really high volume. So, but in the end, doesn't, you know, high school, college, young club, 75% is kind of that number. I certainly think that the lower the level you are, the more that you should hold yourself to a little bit higher standard, probably in the 80% range. If you're struggling to steal at an 80% range, if you're, you know, outside of the college ranks, I think you just maybe start to trim down the amount of times you run players that don't necessarily have that natural speed or that natural base running read ability, the jump that you need. Just kind of starting to maybe trim that a little bit, but it's certainly the opportunities are out there, and just knowing the break even spot for you. And certainly, you know, that's one of those things that in the last 5 years, I think that is one of the changes. That's where, you know, these companies are starting to come in and being able to use the metrics to put together run expectancy charts to be able to give you exact break even percentages according to the players that you've got in that situation, the runner and the hitter. So there's definitely tools out there in the market that are NFCA companies, as far as being at the convention and advertising and whatnot, that can provide that and give a coach that really is interested in making the most informed and best decisions about when and where to run and when and where to bunt, when and where to put people in the lineup.
I just have two more questions, Matt. The first one is, in the middle of the year, when you've seen that what you expected to have happen with output isn't happening, you know, I hate the word slump, but it's one that everybody kind of understands. Are you looking at that? Does it change? How often do you fiddle with your batting order?
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, we do fiddle with it. There's no question that, you know, we're starting to see one evolve for ourselves come, you know, as a January 19th, getting ready to play in a few weeks here, kind of have one in our mind. Now, I'm also willing to bet that that's not the one that we're probably going to be playing with in May. And even if we stayed healthy throughout the course of the board and still had the same nine players, I think that it may adjust through time. It just tends to be that way. I will say that I think sometimes, as humans, we get a little bit emotional with the decisions of when people struggle at times. I think that, you know, it's that balance between how long do I stay and how quickly do I go? And some of that is dependent upon the person. I will say that across the board, you have to have a grasp on, I mean, even if you were a 500 level hitter, which we tend to only have not even some seasons at the Division One level will we have even have a single player that hits 500. You know, sometimes we'll have two, sometimes we'll have three, but as many seasons as we've got that, we've got two times as many seasons where nobody hits 500. And I'm just using that as a number. That's literally just kind of a coin flip. I mean, it's literally could be represented by a coin flip. It's flipping a coin and the coin flips heads and it's a hit, and it flips tails and it's an out. And in the end, it's not going to be a situation where if you flip a coin 200 times that you're going to get, like, you're not going to get sequencing of events just randomly through the way that numbers fall and the way that it works. And the reason that I say that is if you had a 500 level hitter, but for some reason, just by chance alone, they're in a stretch of, it's not out of the realm for them to see stretches of 1-for-9 or 0-for-9 or 2-for-16, just by, if you just flipped a coin and kind of did that in front of you. So then it just becomes, okay, are they really in a slump, or is this just something that just happens randomly in nature in the way that probability works? And so you've got to kind of balance. And I say that just to those player or those coaches that as soon as a player has one or two bad outings, they just tend to feel like they need to make a move in the lineup. And I think that the more that we can be less emotional, more thoughtful, more intentional with our decisions, I think the more that we can help players not be as quite as emotional with the failure rate in our sport. And so certainly there's a point at which you're not going to sit there and keep them in, you know, you're not going to 27 on that front. And maybe you're not going to, you're certainly going to move them up and down in the lineup if they're hot or cold at that spot. It just, it, I think there has to be a little bit of a balancing of the emotions of it, understanding the way that probability works and how much stuff bunches together and how much really seasons are made, put together. I'm telling you right now, if you look at the makeup, just both in probability standpoint, and then when you're dealing with human beings, a 333 hitter's season is made up of many more sequences of like 2-for-3 and 3-for-3 days paired with, like a 3-for-3 day paired with 2 0-for-3 days, or like a 3-for-3 and a 2-for-3 to get you to 5 paired with a couple of 0-for-3s and a 1-for-3 day. It's not made up of a bunch of 1-for-3 days. It just doesn't work that way. Emotionally, there's just too much psychology associated with that. There's too much generally, if you were to just have a random number generator generate you numbers, you're going to get bunching of numbers together on that. And so it's just, like I said, I think it's hard sometimes as a coach to not get it into that emotional trap. But I think it's to answer your question, at Arkansas, we try to be a little bit more intentional, that we certainly are going to make moves. If you look at, I will say this, you could, we don't have this metric out there, but you have, sometimes you have in 50, 60 games, you'll have coaches that'll put together 52 different lineups, right? And sometimes you'll have coaches that'll put together 12, you know, maybe 4 different lineups. And sometimes different years are different ways. Sometimes in a year, one coach might put together 52, and maybe they'll put together 36. But over the course of time, you got to be real careful. I would be real cautious if that metric was tracked and you fell into somebody that was made, had the most amount of lineups every year, and without even changing personnel in and out. I'd be real careful to jostle, be somebody that jerks around your lineup too quickly.
Yeah, I think there's a reason we haven't seen like a Joe DiMaggio hitting streak come close to being broken, right? It's such a unique thing. And heck, I play beat the streak and I can't even do it with picking a different player every day. So, you know, it's what,
yeah, just the probability is just,
yeah,
it literally likely, I mean, if you ran the probability on that, you're probably talking about it once every 210 year event. You mean it just happened for him at that moment? You mean, and it might be another 80 years before we see that again. It'll happen again, but it's going to be so few, and it may not, certainly it's not going to be in most of our lifetime.
For sure. All right. My last question, and this is just for fun, for people that are listening and this is their thing. So it's not the surface listener. You're talking to someone who's much more your peer than, say, I am. What's your favorite couple of crazy stats that maybe somebody has not heard of, that it's not easy to find, but that you think is a really neat indicator of something? It might be hitting, it might be pitching, it could be anything, but what are a couple of the high level metrics that you enjoy looking at?
Yeah, I think that weighted on base average would be probably kind of the gold standard of offensive metrics. It's, I'm not going to explain it for those out there. You can kind of look it up, but weighted on base average in our sport in baseball, it's kind of that offensive metrics that kind of really goes into some of the real high end WAR metrics on the baseball end. You can calculate it in our sport, and it is calculated. I think that's at one. Weighted runs created is big still. I think that I still think that OPS is gonna, even if you put up the best out there and the most advanced out there, you know, OPS is still going to sit probably in a 3 or 4 spot, just to kind of let you know. From a base stealing standpoint, like stolen bases, runs created, that's a good one. Runs created is a good one. I mean, anything that is in kind of just a quick little Google search for those of you guys. I mean, like you said, speaking to the people that are going to know this, but those, just do a quick Google search on those terms that I've said. From a pitching standpoint, fielding independent pitching, FIP, we don't necessarily weight it, have as many ways to weight it. So there's no like X FIPs in our sport necessarily, but FIP would be a good one out there. Defensive efficiency rating would be the best one for the rate at which you make outs, your defense makes outs, certainly a lot better than fielding percentage. Those would be the kind of the gold standard in metrics from a pitching standpoint, defensive standpoint, offensive standpoint.
Well, very cool. And that will give a lot of people some things to Google on the bus in the next coming months. So appreciate that, Matt. And thank you for taking the time and chatting with us and talking a little bit about this and, you know, continuing to help us learn and really critically look at how we do things and just challenge what we know. It's always important to do. So appreciate the time today.
Yeah, always a pleasure. Thanks for having me, Joanna.
You bet. For those of you that are listening, we will be back next week, another brand new episode. We'll be talking catching and getting ready for the season with Coach Barry Mantz. You can get all the archives at fca.org or wherever you find your own podcasts. And if you have an idea, make sure you reach out, social media, email. You can hit us up and we will definitely come back to you with the topic. Revisiting this one was a request from a couple of different coaches, so I promise we're listening. And until then, this is Joanna Lane, Senior Director of Education for the NFCA and The Dirt, NFCA podcast presented by Netting Professionals.
Thanks again for listening to The Dirt, NFCA podcast presented by Netting Professionals. We encourage you to let us know what topics you would like covered in future episodes. Join us again next week for another exciting podcast.